Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. Today, smart nutrition with our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. What are the food trends we can anticipate in the coming months? Has the kale moment passed? And what about one of the latest diet fads, eating anything you want as long as it fits your macros? Well, if it helps you fit into your jeans, why not? Plus, how practical is it to eat in season year-round? And when it comes to eating healthy, what does healthy actually mean when it's slapped on a label? The FDA appears to be evolving on the criteria companies need to claim that their products are indeed healthy. What's making them change their minds? Fear not, the Nutrition Diva will tell all. We'll take your calls and emails, answer your questions, and separate fact from fiction. Smart Nutrition on Midday, coming right up after the news. Welcome to Midday, everybody. It's time today for another installment of Smart Nutrition here on the program. I'm Tom Hall, and to help us separate the wheat from the chaff when it comes to the overwhelming amount of nutrition and diet information that floats around us at every turn, we look to the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. Monica is an author and a licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. We'll take your calls, your comments, and your questions this hour about good nutrition. You can give us a buzz at 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org. Or drop us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. Monica, good to see you. How you doing?
Hi, Tom. Doing great.
So you are just back from a big conference about nutrition that happened in the town that we first met each other
That's right.
Back in Beantown, Boston. And of course, I moved from Boston 35 years ago, so it's been a while since I've lived there, but I have had the great honor of going back for work every so often. But you and I knew each other back in music school. That's why we call you the Nutrition Diva. You're a singer on top of everything else. So up in Boston, this big conference, what is it about? It sounds like it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, this is the annual Food and Nutrition Conference and Expo that is put on every year by the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. So this is the big annual show for dietitians and thousands and thousands of nutrition professionals from all over the country. And I always think we better just hope that no nutrition emergencies break out anywhere, because every dietitian in the country is in one place. But so, yes, I just got back last night from Boston from this conference, and it's always very stimulating, tons of new research, just learning what people are doing out in the field and in so many different aspects of nutrition. So my head is just buzzing with new information and insights.
I mean, I think a lot of our heads buzz when it comes to nutrition.
Yeah.
There's just so much out there, and you hear, there's various foods and drinks are, on the it list, and then they're taken off and put on the opposite of it list, somebody will say, a glass of bourbon a day, will keep you alive to 150. And then, 3 months later, oh, nope, never drink bourbon again, or it'll kill you tomorrow. So, I mean, keeping track of the trends and keeping track of, the sort of perceived wisdom about what we're supposed to be eating and how we're supposed to be living, it's complicated.
It is a lot. And, what comes through the media, certainly, and the sort of popular trends is a whole other, track. At least at this conference, you get a chance to kind of drill down a little bit and to see what's actually going on in the front line of research. And there are definitely trends that are happening in research and in product development, but sometimes it's a little bit different than what we're getting on the consumer side through the media about what's trendy. And sometimes there's some confluence. For example, right now in the sort of popular culture, we're so fascinated with fermented and cultured foods, right? There's all these little pop-up boutiques where you can get artisanal sauerkraut and unpasteurized pickles and kimchi, and I know there's some stands down at the both the Sunday Farmers Market and the Waverly Market where I go on Saturday morning. So it's all about the fermented foods, and it turns out This was also what they were talking about, what everyone was very excited about at this conference this year, all the new research going on into the microbiome.
Yeah, microbiome. So yeah. That's one of those words that floats out there in the ether world. But what is it?
Well, that's a word that's used to describe the community of microscopic organisms that live in and on our bodies. So, you know, a little while ago, it became obvious that we are not alone. You know, we think of ourselves as sort of sovereign beings here, but we're actually just a host to a universe of tiny bacteria and viruses and fungi. They live in our skin, they live in our mouths, they live in our digestive tracts. And it turns out
they're good. Or they can be good.
They can be good. They can be bad. But what's interesting is how much impact they have on our health. They are a really important part of our well-being is determined by the makeup and well-being of these bugs that we carry around. Who knew? So microbiologists are the new nutritionists. That's where all the interesting stuff is happening right now.
Interesting. So there are some of these bugs that we do want to pay attention to and do correct care and feeding, right? And others we want to get rid of. I mean, is this kind of that thing like people say that hand sanitizers, you know, the prevalence of hand sanitizers and people using them all the time gets rid of, you know, the wrong kind of bacteria. There are people who think that using hand sanitizers is a bad idea because it gets rid of some biological matter that actually could help us develop immunity to illness and stuff. Is this the inside the gut version of that kind of argument?
Well, there's not a whole lot we can do to sanitize our digestive tract. So right. Actually, no, I take that back. When we take antibiotics, that's right. Essentially what we're doing is applying the antibacterial soap to the insides. And yes, that does have some negative consequences. There's a whole investigation about right now about whether we're just keeping our homes and our children too clean, you know, all of the antibacterial soaps that we use, throughout our homes, that kids are no longer exposed to the kind of just sort of environmental bacteria that they would have been when they grew up on farms, and that this is maybe one of the reasons that we see so much higher levels of allergy and immune problems is that, you know, we didn't have a chance to build up a robust immunity because we're keeping our environments too sanitized. You know, obviously there's a time and a place for bugs and for right. cleanliness. But yeah, you're right. That's part of the conversation.
I mean, when it comes to kids and immunity, I mean, my wife and I, Linnell and I, our answer was send our kid to daycare. It was right. like a biofarm of every known disease to humankind. And she, you know, Miranda became very immune to, she was not a sick kid. And I really think it had a lot to do with just the exposure she had to all of those germs and those other kids. But that's a topic for a different day, perhaps. But the microbiomes, I mean, if we know that we want to care and feed and nurture some of the microbiomes that are in our gut in particular, how do we know which ones mm-hmm. we want to nurture and which ones we want to get rid of?
Yeah, well, we don't.
Do they carry signs?
Well, we can type them by, you know, phyla and strain and all of that. But we don't know with any great degree of precision because there's so many. I mean, we're just getting started with the process of cataloging them. But we can do some things with just kind of seeing, you know, of the top six categories, you know, how much is represented. What we know so far is that rather than thinking like I want bug A and I don't want bug B, is that the greater variety, the greater diversity of bacteria that we're carrying around in our gut, that seems to be, you know, the most protective rather than trying to set up sort of boutique communities where we've, you know, where we've thrown out everybody we don't want and installed just the, you know, the six superbugs. Well, actually, superbug has a different word, doesn't it? The six, you know, most desirable probiotics that are the real play here is in just trying to increase the overall diversity of the bacteria.
So anytime we eat these fermented vegetables or products that call themselves probiotic, mm-hmm. they're doing what? They're introducing some of these little critters into the gut? I mean, how does it actually work?
Yeah.
You hear this term, probiotic is like microbiome. You hear that term all the time. I'm not 100% sure that at least I know what that actually means.
I know what it means, but I'm not sure we know what it does. So probiotic food is any food that still has live and active cultures or bacteria in it. So when you buy your tub of yogurt at the grocery store, on the side you'll see a little panel that says contains live and active cultures. And that means they haven't killed the bacteria in that yogurt, the bacteria that made the yogurt, by pasteurizing it. It's still alive. And the same thing with fresh sauerkraut hasn't been canned, you know, so it hasn't been pasteurized. It's still got the lactobacillus bacteria that fermented it are still in there. So that's what we mean by probiotic foods, are foods that still have those live bacteria in them. What they do when we eat them, that's a much thornier issue. You know, there's a sort of simplistic view that, okay, we'll just eat these foods that contain the bacteria, and then the bacteria will be in us, and we're done. But it's obviously not that simple. For one thing, before they can get to our gut, before they can get to our large intestine, they have to go through our stomach, which is a very acidic environment. And acid, with enough acid that it might actually kill a lot of those bacteria.
I would imagine that different stomachs have different levels of acidity too, right?
Yeah, depends on how many acid-blocking drugs you're taking,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
for sure. And, you know, what else you're eating.
So one fermented pickle might, you know, have a deleterious effect on a person, and another fermented pickle have a salubrious effect? I mean, does it work like that? Is that a weird way of framing it?
I guess if you got a bad bug in your pickle jar, you know, that could create some problems. But no, it's just that I'm not sure it's as simple as saying if we eat a lot of bacteria, then those bacteria will end up in our digestive tract. It seems to be a lot more complex. It doesn't mean that they're not beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, they may certainly be having beneficial effects.
But we don't actually know if they make it all the way.
Exactly.
Through the little field they've got to run through.
Yeah, yeah. It's a long tube, you know, and they go through a lot to get there. And that's why you often see criticisms or exposés of probiotic supplements in particular, that people are spending a lot of money on probiotic pills that supposedly contain these live and active cultures, and we're not sure what benefit that's really producing in terms of introducing those bacteria into our gut.
Interesting, because you think if the bacteria is going to have a difficult time running the gauntlet of the large intestine,
right,
you know, what would make the bacteria in a pill have an easier time of
exactly
running the same gauntlet?
Yeah, yeah. At least in the food, they've got a kind of a food matrix to travel with, you know, as opposed to the pill. So, you know, you're
But generally speaking, it's a good thing to have these kinds of live bacteria in your system. I mean, overall,
there's no
worried that there's a downside.
No, and it does seem to be, you know, part of a healthy and wholesome diet. But what may be even more important than quote unquote stocking the pond may be what we're eating that to feed and nurture the bacteria that are already in the gut. That may actually be the more impactful.
And that's what we don't know so much about, right? We don't quite know how the best way to feed them.
There's some good news. I just heard a great session on my way to the airport to Boston yesterday that was about this. But it's not terribly sexy, you know, so it's not going to launch a million new products. And so we may have some trouble getting some attention for this. But really, when you're eating a diet that's high in fiber, and this is the old stuff, right? The fruits and vegetables, legumes, dried beans, nuts and seeds, all those and whole grains, you know, that fiber in those foods, that's what feeds the beneficial bacteria. And when you have a lot of that kind of fiber in your diet, we really can see some pretty predictable positive changes in the population in the gut. And when you're eating a lot of meat and sugar and fried foods, then we see changes in the other direction. We see an overgrowth of the bacteria that tend to thrive on that kind of a food supply. So we're getting there.
So the good stuff that we know we should be eating anyway, vegetables,
right,
fiber, you know, things mm-hmm. rich in fiber, nuts, things rich in nutrients, like that. Obviously, this is just an additional benefit. I mean, it benefits us in a bunch of other ways. Plus, it feeds the biofarm pretty nicely, right?
Right. And that may turn out to be a pretty sizable piece of the benefit. It may not just be like a little incremental plus. Yeah. It may actually be a big part of the puzzle.
Interesting. It's Smart Nutrition today on Midday with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org, or drop us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. Before we take a quick break, congratulations to the National Aquarium here in Baltimore. Smart CEO Magazine has given the aquarium the 2016 Healthiest Company Award for companies with 250 to 399 employees. The award recognizes the programs that the aquarium makes available to all of its workers that promote their health and well-being. This is the second year in a row that the aquarium has been honored, so kudos to the folks down there at the aquarium. I wonder if they're all pescatarians. Or if they like don't eat any fish at all. We'll have to figure that out. I'm Tom Hall. We want you to stay healthy, and we want you to stick around. We'll be right back.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, looking ahead tonight here on WYPR, the final debate of the presidential campaign. NPR will have complete coverage starting at 9 o'clock, and we'll have live fact-checking on the WYPR website. Then tomorrow here on Midday, we'll have analysis and reaction from Liz Copeland, the founder of the Urban Conservative Project, and Malia Cromer, the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will be here to review Das Barbecue at the Audrey Herman Spotlighters Theater. That's all coming up Midday Thursday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Monica Reinagle, the nutrition diva. We welcome your questions and comments about healthy eating and healthy living. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And you can drop us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. So, Monica, I do want to ask you about kale in particular. Did anybody talk about kale in Boston at this big thing? Because kale seems like one of those foods, kind of like, you know, quinoa, which I'd never heard of before, you know, like maybe 5 years ago, and kale, which frankly I had never heard of 5 years ago. And all of a sudden I'm eating it all the time. But I'm getting over kale.
You're not the only one.
I'm getting over kale.
Is that good news? Kale's moment seems to be ebbing. Yes, it was because the last few shows, and also we have a big natural products show in Baltimore every year in September, separate show that happens down in the convention center, and where they showcase all the new health food products and natural food products. And yeah, for a few years, it was just all kale all the time. And that seems to be on its way out. So kale has run its course.
It's no less good
still
for
good.
You. It's no less good for you.
It's still good, but we don't have to, right. It doesn't have to be in every chip and salad.
I've had the best kale dishes I've had have been in restaurants. I mean, there are chefs who are really good at preparing it, and I'm not so good at it, I think. I mean, I've tried it a bunch of different ways, but I've eaten in restaurants where they just do a bang-up job, so I think I'm just going to order out for kale.
There you go.
From now on.
Yeah. That's right.
Sustainability. That's one of those words. That's another word like microbiome. You know, that's a word that people throw around. And I imagine they were talking a lot about sustainability at this nutrition conference in Boston as well, because that is something that corporate interests are tied to. All of us who want to do things that are good for the planet and, you know, or at least appear to be good for our environment, both locally and globally. Is there much consensus on the word sustainability? Do people actually know what that means?
It is a big buzzword, definitely in the food culture and in nutrition culture. And it is kind of poorly defined. You know, we're not sure exactly what it is that we're talking about. And so people can use it to mean anything that they want to use it to mean. But I think there's a general sense among consumers that sustainability should mean growing practices and manufacturing and transport practices that minimize the use of resources, that are, you know, efficient with resources that don't strip the land of nutrients, you know, that leave the land as good or better than it was before after you harvest that crop, rather than depleting the environment, that leave the water clean, that leave the air clean. So I think we have a, it's like pornography. We know it when we see it, right?
Yeah.
We may not be able to define it, but we have a general sense.
I mean, we can be easily hip to products that are not sustainably made. I mean, you know, if the packaging on a product, or if it's in terms of food, if it's not a natural product, right? I mean, if it's a ginned up product, I mean, it's probably going to be considerably less sustainable than, you know, a fresh vegetable or something, right?
I think some of that can be a little bit invisible to us, because a lot of the sustainability movement has to do with what's going on farms that may be producing food that we get without any label or wrapper whatsoever. It looks like, you know, a red pepper is, you know, pretty natural, that hasn't been highly processed. And yet the decisions that get made about how that pepper is farmed can have real impact on the sustainability of that product. But because consumers are interested in it, big food manufacturers are talking about sustainability, and it's a word that you're going to hear them use in relationship to their products over and over and over again. And there was
and they're using it as a point of sale.
Yes.
I mean, it's kind of the way some products use philanthropy as a point of sale. You know, 10% of proceeds from the sale of this yogurt will go to, you know, benefit cancer research. I mean, why not just make a donation? That's always bothered me.
We have to choose what we're going to eat. And so this is a way to make one product more desirable than another product. And so, yes, it's something to make it more desirable to the consumer, is to say, you know, our product is more sustainable or sustainable. But I think also there's some enlightened self-interest going on here. We do have a finite amount of resources on this planet with which to produce our food. And so farmers and ranchers and food producers also need to be mindful of the fact that, you know, they can put us all out of business on the, mm-hmm. the most universal yeah.
well,
possible sense, you
yeah.
know, by when we run out of water or so yeah, it's definitely top of mind. There was one really interesting initiative that I heard talked about at the conference on the expo floor that's being led by the cereal company Kashi. They make a lot of mm-hmm. sort of whole grain.
And that has, certainly the vague impression of being healthy for
Kashi,
you.
Kashi, yeah. It's a sort of a healthier brand.
I mean, it ain't Fruit Loops.
They make health food, right. And they have spearheaded a new program where they're trying to support what they call transitional farmers. And these are farmers who are transitioning to organic certification. And that, I don't know if you know too much about how that
process
happens.
So they're not quite there. They haven't been officially certified organic, but they're in the process.
Right. And in order to be certified as organic, you have to be maintaining 100% organic procedures, how you're treating your field and your farm, your animals and everything, for 3 years. You have to have a 3-year track record.
Yes, it's a long process.
And when you get to 3 years, then you may be certified organic. And so this can be difficult for farmers who might be interested in entering the organic market for any reason. Maybe because they want to be more sustainable. They'd like to grow organic food. This can be a real business challenge for them, because they have to spend the money on organic practices for 3 years before they can start charging the premium that we pay for organic products and start getting some of that money back. So it keeps some farmers out of that market, because they don't have the cash flow to do it. So there's a program now to certify those farmers who are in that process. They're already following the organic procedures. They just haven't been doing it for long enough to get their certification, and they're certifying these farmers as transitional. So there's still some oversight. Somebody is still making sure that they're following the regulations, and they're just in that sort of waiting period. And Kashi has made a big sort of industry-wide initiative to their competitors and their peers and, you know, other health food manufacturers, saying, let's support these transitional farmers. Let's source more of our ingredients from these guys.
Which is going to improve their cash flow and help them get through this period of,
exactly.
The sort of audition period.
It makes it safer for farmers to take that step, and it might
Good
encourage more people to go into organic farming. And so, you know, Kashi can't put the certified organic label on a product that they're making, but there's a new label. It's a green tea, and it's, I think, most people probably have not seen this yet. And
that's transitional?
And it stands for transitional, and it means following organic practices, but not yet long enough to be considered organic. And I thought that was a great
Because they then, you know, provide a financial incentive for these farmers
to
keep going. Yeah,
okay, yep.
Well, that's a great idea. Let's go to the phones. Got a bunch of folks wanting to weigh in here. Io is on the phone from Baltimore. Io, welcome to Midday with the Nutrition Diva, Monica Reinagle.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I have a daughter. She's 5 years old. She likes yogurt every morning for the past almost 2 years, especially with banana yogurt. Now, is it good for her? I'm just being curious if that is good for her. She just loves it in the morning, yogurt, banana yogurt.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, thank you for your call. So for children, so this is a five-year-old who's already been eating yogurt almost every day for 2 years. So since she was three, is that a good idea? Is there anything to worry about?
Yeah, absolutely. Cultures have been doing that for millennia. I eat yogurt almost every morning. So yeah, there's nothing wrong with eating that on a regular basis. The only little caveat I'd say is that some of the pre-sweetened yogurts, the fruit-flavored yogurts that you buy in the store, they do have a fair amount of sugar in them. And so the only way we could make that habit just a little bit better for Io's daughter would be to see if she might tolerate unsweetened yogurt with sliced up bananas in it rather than the sweetened yogurt that you get from the grocery store.
Plain yogurt.
And
then put fruit, you know, yeah, blueberries,
mash some bananas, whatever. And stir it in so that you get that sweetness and it's a little bit less sweet. And then you get that benefit, you know, the protein and the calcium from the milk, the beneficial bacteria without that sort of offsetting factor of all of that added sugar.
All right. Good call, Io. Thank you for that call. We're going to go to Peter in Baltimore. Peter has a question about drinking water. We're told we're supposed to drink a lot of water. I'm interested in what you have to say about this, Peter. Welcome to Midday with the Nutrition Diva.
Thank you. I'm just finishing up my lunch and salad.
Well done.
You get extra points, Peter. That's right. So far, it's Peter 10, Tom and Monica 0.
Actually, it's more a question. I don't have a statement to make, but it came up in a dinner conversation the other night with some friends, is what is the value or the caveat against drinking water or any beverage, for that matter, with your meals, whether it actually dilutes digestive juices or otherwise washes away nutrients while you're eating?
Yeah, that question comes up perennially, and there's really no reason to be concerned about drinking beverages or water with your meal. This question about whether water might dilute your digestive juices, not something that we need to worry about unless you're drinking like, you know, 3 or 4 gallons of water with your meal. Consider that salad that you just had for lunch, those vegetables.
That's got a lot of water in it anyway.
It's 90 to 95% water. So if you're eating a salad, you're taking in a fair amount of water and it's not diluting your digestive juices. So this is not something that we need to worry about not drinking with our meals because it's going to impair digestion or degrade the nutrients in any way. In fact, it helps to, you know, mix up all the food a little bit more and help it move through the digestive system more efficiently. So,
all right. Thanks for your call, Peter. That's good to know. We're going to keep going to the phones here. Michael is on the phone from Baltimore. Michael, welcome to Midday with our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle.
Yes, I wanted to make a comment about the value of the garden movement in schools, exposing children to growing things and getting their hands in the dirt. I work with a garden at St. Pius and Roots and Branches, and we've got some really big pumpkins out there. And so the whole idea of seeing something from seed to table and the whole educational dimension, maybe your guests can comment about the value of that.
Thanks for your call, Michael. Yeah, I just did an event last weekend at the Great Kids Farm, which was founded by a woman named Jill Wrigley, who very sadly passed away just a couple weeks ago, and a guy named Tony Geraci, who was for a while the head of the school system's foods. And the idea was to have the Great Kids Farm produce a lot of food that the kids in the school system would eat. They've sort of tamp that grand plan down a little bit, but they still produce a lot of food and they teach kids about you know, where food comes from and how to make it well. It was a great event. We had all these teams made dishes that involved, in many cases, food from the farm. It was a terrific thing. Great Kids Farm. You should look it up if you're interested. But this is a big movement, and it's good the kids in the next generation are going to know about this in a way that we didn't.
I love this movement. I just think it has so many positive benefits for everybody. For one thing, it gets our kids their hands in the dirt. That's one of the ways they get those beneficial bacteria on board, the way we started our hour this morning. You know, let's not have them be so clean in their playing on their iPads. Let's get them out there in the dirt. But yes, the value of teaching kids to garden and helping them understand how food is produced is inestimable. And it also gets kids more interested and excited about eating fruits and vegetables. You know, I always say, if you want to get a kid excited about a green bean, let him grow it himself. You know, the kids cannot wait to cook and eat food that they have had a hand in growing. So I love the educational benefits for the kids to seeing. I mean, what a great way to learn biology and environmental sciences and, you know, all the things that you learn growing a green bean. And what a great way to introduce them into a real food culture and increase their appreciation and enjoyment of fresh whole foods. I think every school
certainly
should do
it. No downside. And there's, you know, if schools aren't doing it, or if the school that your children is attending, your children are attending, isn't doing it, the neighborhoods can do it. There's all these urban farms mm-hmm. now. There are all these community gardens. There's all these, you know, patches that people have, you know, found out and throughout the city, certainly. And they're growing stuff right, you know, right next door to where these kids are living. So get them going.
It's terrific. And then what we would need to do to kind of close the gap there is then also do more kitchen and culinary literacy with our kids, you know, help them get more comfortable in the kitchen. We have a whole generation of parents who have now come up in a time when they did not learn cooking as a skill either at home or in school. They don't know how to cook. They're very uncomfortable. They'll watch a lot of cooking shows on TV, you know, they'll watch the Food Network all day long, but they really don't feel comfortable in the kitchen. Yeah. And so they can't pass that on to their kids. And it's another good thing. Another big part of raising healthy eaters is raising kids who know what to do in the kitchen.
Let's take another call before we take a little break. Farouk in Baltimore, you're on Midday with the Nutrition Diva. Thanks for your call.
Yes, good afternoon, sir. A very good program, very, very good program. My problem is that I'm a little bit heavy. I'm 220 pounds. And also the polio and my left leg, working hard to walk. So doctor told me that to cut your sugar.
Cut the sugar in your diet.
And cut your, I'm scared about the cholesterol. But let me tell you, I'm in another part of the world, and I'm basically from Pakistan, and our food, I don't know, you know, every day we have bread, home bread, rice, chicken curry, oat curry, all kind of stuff, and potatoes, and I don't know what to cut. I mean, sugar, if I eat rice, I had a lot of sugar. If I eat bread, I had a lot of sugar. I did not even eat the egg because I am a little bit older.
Yeah, that's a good question, Farouk. I appreciate the call. So Farouk's dilemma is one that a lot of us face, that a lot of us are eating sugar that we don't even know we're eating. I mean, there's sugar permeates so many foods. It's tough to avoid sugar, isn't it? But if we do avoid sugar, it's going to have a very helpful effect to weight control and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, let's qualify it and talk about added sugars. So not the naturally occurring sugars that are present in fruits, but the sugar, the refined sugar that's added to foods. That's probably a great place to look to cut some calories. One place that I think we often forget to look is in the beverages that we drink. We drink about 50% of the added sugar that the typical American consumes is in beverages. In soda, in sweetened iced.
50%.
50%.
Wow.
And we eat, and we also typically, on average, and, you know, Farouk comes from a culture where this may not be part of his traditional diet, but the typical American diet, yeah, is getting about twice as much added sugar as the recommendations, and 50% of it is coming from beverages. So for me, I feel like, okay, start with the beverages. You might be able to solve the problem right there. But it creeps in sweetened coffee, sweetened tea, soda, Also, energy drinks. You know, a lot of people drink
Gatorade, that kind of stuff.
Or Smart Water, vitamin water. All of these sweetened beverages, and that adds up a lot quicker than people realize. So that's one place to look. And then the next place to look, instead of worrying too much about, you know, a little bit of sugar that might be in your ketchup or your salad dressing, I'd say the next place to look is in the foods that taste sweet. Desserts.
Fancy that.
Desserts, sweetened breakfast cereals, pastries, those kinds of things. You know, we don't want to focus on the tiny amounts before we've taken care of the big amounts.
Monica Reinagle is the Nutrition Diva. She's a licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. Before we take a quick break, a few items from our mailbag this week. Our show on Monday on rape culture included Roxanne Melgar from Turnaround, a sexual assault and domestic violence center. Nancy wrote in on Monday to say, I am grateful for the topic. First, thank you to Turnaround and places like it. In 1991, I was raped by a stranger with a machete. My counselor helped me take the first steps to functioning and eventually healing. It's a process that continues today, 25 years later. Second, I haven't heard anyone yet use the word crime in connection to any of the terms rape, sexual assault, or sexual violence. This is critical. This is the first thing I've taught my daughters, ages 10 and 12, about violence against women by anyone. It is a crime. And earlier this month, in my conversation with Republican U.S. Senate candidate Kathy Shalega, Delegate Shalega made a statement implying that all of the Democrats in Congress voted to support the Affordable Care Act when it was passed in 2010. Connie wrote in to point out that the ACA was passed by a just barely Democrat-led Senate on December 24, 2009, pretty much along party lines. When the Democrat-controlled House took up a similar version of the bill on March 21, 2010, it passed with 34 Democrats opposing it and not a single Republican supporting it. We appreciate hearing from everyone during and after the time that we broadcast midday. You can always be in touch via email, midday@wipr.org, or on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. When we come back, we'll have more from the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. You can join our conversation on the phone as well, 410-662-8780. Stick around.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
I guess I do have a question about the chicken, if you could just tell us a little bit more about it.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board, organic.
The hazelnuts, these are local.
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres. So here is the chicken you'll be enjoying tonight.
You have this information. This is fantastic.
Absolutely. His name was Colin. Here are his papers, okay?
That's great. He looks like a happy little guy who runs around. A lot of friends, other chickens as friends. Putting his little wing around another one and kind of like palling around.
I don't know that I can speak to that level of intimate knowledge about him. They do a lot to make sure that their chickens are very happy.
When you say they, I mean, who are these people raising Colin?
It's a farm that's located about 30 miles south of Portland.
It tears at the core of my being the idea of someone just cashing in on a trend like organic.
No, I know the type, no.
Yeah.
Tell you what, we're gonna go check it out if you don't mind. If you could hold our seats.
Oh, now?
Yeah, we'll be right back. We'll just want to make sure.
Thank you so much, Dana.
Sure.
That's it. Speaking of farm to table, that's Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein and the actress Dana Milliken. Talking about farm-raised healthily raised chickens on my favorite program on television, Portlandia. The nutrition diva Monica Reinagle joins me today for another installment of Smart Nutrition. You can join us as well, 410-662-8780. Drop us a tweet @MiddayTomHall or send us an email, midday@wipr.org. I mean, you can really take this, farm-to-table stuff a little too.
I love that
a
clip.
Little too seriously. It's kind of fun, but it's interesting. I think one of the things they were talking about in Boston that I read about was this notion of labeling things healthy. There are people who are actually using that word on their products, saying, this is healthy for you. How do they know?
Yeah.
What's the criteria for that?
Well,
the FDA monitors that stuff.
Right.
The Food and Drug Administration.
You can't just slap that word healthy on your product or even on the advertisement for your product unless the FDA agrees with your assessment. And this has recently come up for discussion because last year, a company that produces snack bars that are made out of, nuts and whole grains, like a pretty wholesome product, was calling their product healthy, and the FDA threw a flag on the play and said, you can't call that bar healthy because it's got more than 10% of calories from fat. And a bunch of other nutrition folks stepped in and said, I'm sorry, this bar is mostly, all these fats are coming from nuts. There's nothing unhealthy about nuts. There's nothing unhealthy about the fats from nuts. And that rule is an outdated throwback to the 70s when we were...
Yeah, fat is no longer the demon.
Fat is no longer the enemy. So this is kind of...
Or at least certain kinds of fat. I mean, fat that comes from certain places isn't the demon.
Even total fat.
Stuff on the edge of the steak? I can eat lots and lots of that?
Well, but the point is that we don't need to restrict our total fat intake to 15 or 20% of our calories anymore, the way they told us that we were supposed to back in the 70s. But that old fat phobia is still lurking in some of these regulations. And so this one case about this nut bar has provoked the FDA to open up their definition of healthy for some public comment and some expert input, and they're going to come back with a new definition. They're going to rethink their stance on fat so that we can go ahead and call something made primarily out of nuts as healthy, which I think is healthy.
I mean, are these nuts in this bar, covered in oil and all that kind of stuff? I mean, is there any bad fat in the product, or in products that they're currently calling unhealthy?
No, I think there was some sweetener involved in gluing all the nuts together. But no, I mean, really, by no modern criteria could you have looked at this and thought, like, oh, that's not healthy. But
I mean, it's one thing to call something gluten-free. You know that it is or it isn't. It's another thing to call something organic.
Healthy.
But healthy, that's a pretty broad term.
To be honest with you, Tom, I kind of wish we weren't having this conversation for a couple of different reasons. I think you can't take any one food and stamp it healthy or unhealthy in a vacuum because you're eating that food in a context of other
How
foods.
How much of it are you eating? And exactly. What are you eating with it?
What are you eating with it? And what are you eating it instead of? And so all of those questions come into play. I just don't think healthy is one of those up-down votes that we can make on single foods.
All right, we got a gazillion phone calls. I'm going to do my best to get to all of them. Patty is with us from Walkersville. Patty, welcome to Midday with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle.
Hi, Monica. How are you?
Hi, Patty.
I wanted to ask about the preponderance of a fiber product called inulin, which I believe is also chicory root. It's in so many of the diet foods that are out there now and so many of the protein breakfast-type bars and even in the dessert products that are put out by some of the, I won't mention the names, but some of the diet companies. And it doesn't agree with me. It doesn't agree with several of my friends. And we've all been wondering why, number one, it's creeping into so many products that we used to eat. It wasn't in there. Now we have to be very careful reading the labels to make sure it's not there. But number two, it just seems like there's just way too much fiber being added to so many products that I don't think we need that much fiber in our diet.
Interesting. Well, thanks for the call, Patty. So chicory root, what's the deal with that, Monica?
Well, it's high in a certain type of fiber called soluble fiber that can sometimes cause some digestive issues for people. So it doesn't surprise me that Patty finds that she's particularly sensitive to inulin. It's probably the soluble fiber that's in there that's causing some rumbling. People have different levels of sensitivity to it. But that's an interesting observation that she feels like there's too much fiber in our food. I mean, the recommended intake for fiber for adults is between 25 and 30 grams a day, and the average intake is about half of that. So as a population anyway, across the board, it doesn't look like we're getting too much fiber. And this kind of goes back to the conversation we were having at the top of the hour about the microbiome, that fiber, including soluble fiber, including inulin and chicory root, are one of the fibers that feed those beneficial bacteria in the gut. So that doesn't mean that that's going to be well tolerated by everyone, but there are some good reasons. The only other thing I'll add is that I noticed that Patty was mentioning several, in specific, a lot of diet foods that are containing this. And the reason for that is that a lot of diet foods are sweetened with artificial sweeteners, whether it's things like stevia. And those sweeteners have to have a carrier, like they're cut with inulin or fiber so that they can be measured and shaken and stirred, so that they're more usable. It's sort of a filler. And I think it's seen as generally a you know, a beneficial filler. It's fiber. Fiber is good for us. And so if you're eating a lot of artificially sweetened foods, you are likely to be encountering an awful lot of inulin right now because they pair them together to make that ingredient a little bit more useful.
Like everything, you take, you've got to take a little good with the bad sometimes. Yeah,
yeah, cut out the artificial sweeteners.
Yeah, cut out the sweeteners, yeah, yeah.
Because they do not feed the healthy bacteria in your gut. They, the opposite.
They ain't helping anything, right? Tyler in Annapolis, welcome to Midday. Glad you called.
Hi, I have a question about hydration.
Yeah.
I understand coffee and tea are diuretics, but I wonder, if they have so much water in them, do they hydrate you or are they a neutral benefit? Is there any nutrition benefit to them?
That's an interesting question. I mean, is drinking coffee or tea as good for hydration as drinking plain water?
Oh, Tyler, I am so glad you called in with this question because this is a huge myth that's out there that coffee and tea are dehydrating. So here's the deal. Well, first of all, I'll answer the last part of the question first. Yes, both coffee and tea do have health benefits associated with them. They have, they're full of bioactive compounds that benefit the brain and the heart and the circulation. So there are good things in coffee and tea, but they also contain caffeine. That's a chemical.
Sometimes, right?
So unless they've been decaffeinated. Right. They, well, I'm certainly not drinking decaffeinated coffee. I want my caffeine. But so caffeine, the chemical caffeine all by itself is a diuretic. That means it makes you go to the bathroom more. It can be dehydrating. But two things to keep in mind. One, as Tyler has already guessed, there's so much water in the coffee and tea that it more than offsets any diuretic effect from the caffeine. So your net intake is still positive. You are taking in way more fluid than that caffeine is causing you to lose. But the other fun little fact is that if you are a regular consumer of caffeine, if you have a cup of coffee every morning or you drink tea every day with lunch, your body becomes desensitized to that diuretic effect. And so for regular drinkers of caffeinated beverages, even that caffeine is not, doesn't have a diuretic effect. And so you're getting 100% of the fluid value of the coffee and tea. So the answer to the question is no. Coffee and tea is not dehydrating, and yes, it is beneficial.
Right.
If you tolerate it. Some people don't like the way it makes them feel, and that's cool, but
right. That's a whole other issue. Right.
You don't have to worry about it being dehydrating.
Right. All right, Tyler, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. Joanne is calling from Hydes, Maryland. Joanne, welcome to the show. Glad you could call.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. So I've been dealing with stomach issues for about 10 years, and every gastroenterologist I've gone to has just prescribed something and not talked to me at all about diet. I finally found someone through the University of Maryland's Integrative Medicine where they did blood and stool tests and were actually able to say, look, you are just full of bad bacteria. You don't have any of the good bacteria. And she gave me a list of six things to do naturally and through some supplements to help regulate that level of bacteria. And I'm thrilled. It, you know, they're not putting a Band-Aid on it. They're finding out why. And I'm wondering if you see an increase in the mainstream medical field of finally looking at this natural approach versus just prescribing things to help you with your symptoms.
Sure. Thanks for your call, Joanne, and I'm glad that things are turning around and you've been able to turn around through diet. There is just such a close correlation between healthy living and healthy eating, isn't there?
Yes, and I do think the medical profession, which has historically been somewhat blind to the effects of diet, is becoming much more tuned in and working much more closely with nutrition professionals to craft these kinds of more lifestyle-based interventions to be less dependent on drugs. And there's also a big move to do to have more nutrition education as part of the curriculum for medical doctors. But probably even better than that is the team approach, where you can have an MD doing what MDs do best, and nutrition professional and other kinds of health professionals, each in their area of expertise, finding solutions that are looking at the larger picture, not just all of your systems as a human being, but your whole lifestyle then.
Yeah, we had Miho Tanaka on the show a week or two ago, who's an orthopedic surgeon and the head of the Johns Hopkins Women's Sports Medicine Program. And in that program, they've got not just orthopedic specialists who are taking care of, you know, injuries to your shoulder, your knee and stuff, but they've got nutritionists, they've got psychologists, they've got OBGYN docs, they've got people, you know, looking at the whole picture, even related to, I mean, they're relating diet to orthopedic injuries.
Sure,
and stuff,
recovery from injury.
Yeah.
And how do we support
Interesting.
That?
Interesting. Yeah. All right, well, always fun to see you, Monica. We We will see you again soon. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I didn't get to everybody's phone calls and emails today, but Monica will be back. She is the Nutrition Diva. We've got a link to Monica's blog, Nutrition Over Easy, at wypr.org/midday. That'll do it for us today. Reminder that tonight NPR will have complete coverage of the final presidential debate beginning at 9 o'clock, and tomorrow on midday we'll have analysis and reaction from Liz Copeland, the founder of the Urban Conservative Project, and Malia Cromer, the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review Das Barbecue at the Audrey Herman Spotlighters Theater. That's all coming up on midday Thursday. Lunch for our midday guests on Wednesday is provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. Thanks for listening. Thanks to everybody who called and emailed and tweeted today. We'll be back tomorrow at noon. Stay tuned for Future City, our new monthly show hosted by Wes Moore. That's coming up after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.